special guest, somebody who's made a tremendous contribution in the areas of good health, in the areas of consumerism, somebody who you probably have run across. I know you've seen him on radio, television. He's been on many, many shows, including Good Morning America and Nightline. He's also had an opportunity to support your rights in the marketplace in terms of alcohol, in terms of food. He has made a tremendous difference in his organization in the way government takes care of people and the way government administers issues concerning health. And so this morning, my guest, I bring you all the way from, I believe, Washington. Aren't you in Washington, Michael Jacobson?
Yes, I am. Washington, D.C.
Center for Science and the Public Interest. And you may know Michael Jacobson through his periodical, a magazine that comes out every month called Nutrition Action, a magazine that we have gotten and recommended, I guess, for more than 10 years. Hasn't that been the length of your publication?
We first started in 1974. Now we have about 250,000 subscribers.
All right. Well, for years and years and years. In fact, still when we teach our classes and people ask for recommendations on various magazines to keep them up to date on good health and what's going on in the country, I recommend Nutrition Action, and I tell you, I see CNN News, different places around the country. You're still going strong, Michael.
Well, there's serious problems with our food supply, the way food is grown, the way it's packaged, the way it's preserved, and what people are eating. So we try to have an impact on what companies produce, and we try to educate people to eat the healthiest diet they can eat.
Well, just to give me a little bit of background, to fill me in on some things that I don't know about you, you are a PhD in microbiology, graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. How in the world did you get into the politics of food?
Well, after I got my PhD, I decided to take a year off and see if I could do something outside of the laboratory to try to promote a better society. So I came to Washington and interned, really as a volunteer, with Ralph Nader for about a year. And in the very first day I was there, Ralph said to his colleagues, well, what are we going to do with this guy? You know, something about science. And it turned out that they just published a book about the Food and Drug Administration. And they said, well, why don't we have this guy look into food additives? That's what FDA regulates. And so for the next year with Nader, and then another 6 months after that, I researched food additives, an issue in which I had had no previous interest whatsoever. I had no knowledge of nutrition or food additives, and actually that turned out to be a good qualification, because at that time, people pretty much were divided into camps. One camp said every food additive is dangerous. The other camp said every food additive is safe. And I had no preconceived notions, no vested interests, and I was able to identify some problems and also note that most food additives were indeed safe. And one of the other things I noticed was that that the food additives probably posed a much smaller risk in general than the foods in which they're used. So hot dogs have nitrite, but hot dogs are so loaded with fat and sodium that even if they didn't have nitrite, they'd still be awful products. So I began moving from food additives more towards nutrition. And I personally and Center for Science and the Public Interest, which I helped co-found in 1971, have been working on nutrition issues ever since.
So do you think it was somewhat of a scapegoat? Do you think it may be a red herring, the food additive thing, to kind of get people away from really what the problem was? Do you think there was any intention there?
No, not at all. I think that the food industry, of course, was defending the quality, the nutritional quality of its foods also. And people just didn't think about these things. And there is reason to be concerned about food additives. But there isn't a reason to be paranoid and to try to prove that every additive is dangerous. There was much less information about nutrition, much less concern. And the Center for Science and the Public Interest's biggest contributions in the 1970s was to help shift the focus of nutrition concerns from a focus on not getting enough vitamins and minerals to getting too much fat, cholesterol, saturated fat, sugar, sodium, and not enough dietary fiber. And that was a shift that occurred in the 1970s, and that was just so extremely important. And now I and probably you get sick and tired of hearing, turning on television and you see a program, you read an article in Woman's Day, you've watched Donahue's show about the dangers of too much cholesterol. And sometimes I think the message is taking hold, don't you?
I think things are changing. You know, I often try and think back as to why this got started, the idea that the problem was deficiencies of vitamins, minerals, and so on. And I guess that goes back to a couple generations ago when people started refining food and they did get into problems of deficiency, but this day and age it doesn't exist, does it?
That's right. And there really were serious problems in the 30s and before, much of it poverty-related. Rich people didn't have vitamin deficiencies, and they weren't eating whole grains, but they were eating enough food. Especially in the southern United States, there were serious problems with pellagra. But those problems are almost totally eliminated, and now we see, and I think the establishment, the Heart Association and so on, sees the most important nutritional problems as being one of dietary excesses.
Well, there's still a couple of deficiency diseases that are quite popular today. One is iron deficiency, and the other is calcium deficiency. Do you have any comments on those two deficiency problems?
Well, I'm not sure if they are deficiencies. With iron, there's a tremendous amount of controversy about whether our standards are correct for defining an iron deficiency. If they said that, I don't know the exact numbers, but if they said that the appropriate amount is 25% less than the current standard holds, that would eliminate most iron deficiencies. There's a lot of controversy about that. There's also controversy about calcium. Americans consume more calcium than probably any other nation in the world. Yet we have more osteoporosis than just about any other nation in the world. And there is more and more thinking about the relationship between excesses of protein and osteoporosis. When you consume too much protein, the body gets rid of the calcium. And we may be suffering from osteoporosis, not because we're getting too little calcium, but because we're getting too much protein. The average person gets two or three times as much protein as they need.
Well, that's a very important concept to come to, another disease of excess, particularly in the position that you're in, where you're dealing with lobbyists, you're dealing with governmental officials all the time. If we could get that concept across to big government, to the Food and Drug Administration, the idea that we're not dealing with a problem that could be solved with more pepperoni pizza, more ice cream cones, and so on. Instead, we're dealing with a problem that would be solved by the same way we'd solve heart disease and cancer and obesity and constipation in this country. Wouldn't that be exciting if we could just, you know, flop that over right into this osteoporosis propaganda?
And I think there's going to be a lot of resistance because, you know, now the meat industry is beginning to provide lower-fat meat, but eating more low-fat meat is not going to help in terms of osteoporosis.
Or constipation.
That's right. So whether meat is high in fat or not, I think America needs to be moving away from meat. But, you know, when you think of deficiency diseases, I think one of the exciting things in the next 10 years is going to be the research that's being done on the effect of vitamins and minerals on cancer rates and rates of other diseases. I wouldn't be surprised if in 10 years the research shows very clearly that people ought to be taking vitamin supplements with certain minerals and certain vitamins because it may be proven that they have an ability to prevent or reduce the risk of certain kinds of cancer.
Well, I must ask you, is this in the context of eating the rich American diet, which is deficient in the anti-cancer vitamins like C and beta-carotene, or is this in the context of a healthy diet that I know you're moving toward and the rest of the country is moving toward?
Either one, I think. It's not that our diet is so terribly deficient in vitamins A and C. Most people get a fair amount, but it may be that getting more than one could normally get from food will be beneficial. And the vitamin industry, if this turns out to be the case, the vitamin industry will make out like bandits. And there will probably be a proliferation of tremendously deceptive advertising. But still, it may turn out that it would be useful to take supplements.
And the sad thing may be that people react just like they did to Oat Bran. In other words, they sprinkle it on their bacon and eggs.
That's right. That would be a shame.
You're also involved in an area that I've gotten a lot of questions from my listening audience, and that is the area of food irradiation. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to take a break here for just a minute, and then when we get back, I'd like to get involved in the discussion of food irradiation. Maybe you could bring us up to date as to whether this is a reasonable thing to introduce into our supermarkets, or maybe we ought to be a little more cautious and pay a little attention to it. Michael Jacobson is the director for the Center of Science in the Public Interest, and they have an excellent publication that I'm going to give you the address for and encourage you to subscribe. Let me give you a little bit of pricing information here for subscriptions. The cost is $34.95 for 2 years, $19.95 for 1 year, and you can either call, and the number is 202-667-7483, or fax 202-265-4954, and the address is Nutrition Action Circulation Suite 300, 1875 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. And I'll give you all that again because I know that's too much to get in one writing. That'll encourage you to get your pen and pencil out. Michael Jacobson, can you tell me a little bit about food irradiation?
Well, some people see that as the greatest new thing in the world, something that could prevent foodborne illnesses, prevent med flies from moving around the country. And it does offer some benefits. It's an interesting issue. But there are some problems that I think we need to look at before we leap into the food irradiation biz. Food irradiation clearly reduces the nutritional values of foods. The more heavily something is irradiated, the more nutrient is lost. There's also a possibility that there's some toxicity that is engendered in the food because of the irradiation, something that I think has not been studied well enough. And then there's just environmental questions. Having one irradiation facility in Florida is no big deal. But if the food industry goes ahead with its plans, there would be hundreds, even thousands of facilities throughout the country, and that would necessitate the shipping of radioactive cobalt or cesium all over the place all the time. And that's a real concern. I think using radioactivity to preserve foods is like using a sledgehammer to kill an ant. We need to examine alternatives. And it turns out for many uses there are alternatives. Now, this is something that I think Congress, the food industry, the Food and Drug Administration are going to have to look at. One thing that I think most people, even if they aren't concerned about food irradiation, but I think most people could agree that there ought to be better labeling of irradiated foods. Right now, the government requires that if a whole food, like a chicken or a pork chop, is irradiated, it has to have a label that would say treated with irradiation. But if an irradiated food is mixed with a non-irradiated food, it would not have to be labeled. So if you irradiate a cantaloupe and then chop it in half and sprinkle a little lemon juice on it and sell it at a grocery store, that would not have to be labeled treated with irradiation. That needs to be changed. Also, restaurants could serve irradiated foods, and people wouldn't know about it. The law doesn't require restaurants or cafeterias to indicate that food's been treated with irradiation. So we're going to be trying to get better labeling, and also to try to get around the FDA by getting an objective study done by an independent scientific organization to look at the question of irradiation. Is the testing adequate? Should we be concerned about the losses of nutritional value? Are there alternatives that could be used to provide safer poultry or safer fish? And it's a complicated issue, but I think there are enough questions that we shouldn't go running down the road of irradiation quite yet.
Well, there's no question that food irradiation is going to prolong shelf life and increase the profits of industry. But the question is, if I've heard you correctly, is whether or not it's safe, and the burden of proof of safety should rest upon those who are irradiating food, and it doesn't seem to be.
Well, I don't think enough tests have been done.
Right, they have not proved it safe.
They have not proved it. They've proved it safe to the satisfaction of the Food and Drug Administration, but not to me.
Not to the scientific community, as I read in the British Medical Journal either.
Well, there are some scientists who oppose it. Most of those simply have not had any real interest in it. But I think as irradiated food gets closer to the supermarket, there will be more and more interest in this, both in state legislatures and Congress, and among a wider variety of consumer and environmental organizations.
Well, just putting, just because of the association, I mean, us being raised in the atomic age, just putting an irradiated food symbol on the food would kill it. I mean, it would not sell in the markets, do you think?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. Picture this scenario. 300 people die from salmonella poisoning from chicken. People might then go to the grocery store and say, hey, I want chicken that's been irradiated where virtually all the salmonella have been killed. People might even pay extra for it. That's what the industry would like to see. And I think we need to look into alternatives. For instance, the Department of Agriculture is developing a method for eliminating salmonella on chicken simply by dipping it into a vat that contains a safe chemical. If you can do that, who needs radiation? Why build these multi-million-dollar facilities, ship radioactive materials all around the country, if you can just dip the chickens? And I think for other foods, there will be similar approaches to having safe food with a long enough shelf life that doesn't involve radioactivity.
It's a choice between chemotherapy and radiation therapy when it comes to your chicken, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it chemotherapy. There are all different kinds of ways to skin a cat. And for instance, another thing that could be done is fruit is sometimes has insects growing on it, and Texans don't want California fruit because those insects may then infest Texas orchards and vice versa. Well, irradiation is one way to do it, but it may be that carbon dioxide could kill the insects just as effectively as irradiation without having any great risk to consumers.
Well, would it be fair to say in all the years that I've been following you and the Center for Science and the Public Interest that your interest in understanding of food has really caused you to go into a direction of less chicken, less beef, less dairy?
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
In your personal diets and also in your recommendations in your magazine. So maybe another alternative that we ought to be talking to people about is no chicken.
Well, that's certainly a possibility. People, we don't need to eat any individual food in order to live well. And I think there's several million vegetarians in this country, and there will be many millions more in the coming years. And I think everybody ought to be moving in that direction, away from animal foods, more to vegetable-based foods, beans, grains, fruits, vegetables. And I think they'll be healthier for it. I'm not a vegetarian myself, but I certainly have moved a long way in that direction over the past 20 years. 20 years ago, I was eating bologna sandwiches and on white bread, no less. And now there aren't too many chickens that have to worry about me, and beef cattle don't have to worry about me at all.
Well, I would think that as involved as you are in the scientific research, just the subjects we've touched on so far in this half hour, and that is the need for more vitamins, which of course are plentiful in fruits and vegetables, the need to avoid cholesterol and fat, which is a direction of more fruits and vegetables, the need to avoid chemical contamination, additives, and so on, which is more fruits and vegetables. It would be pretty tough, Michael Jacobson, to be in the field that you're in and not find yourself along a path towards less meat, less dairy, more whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. I would think that it would be a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, well, I think in general that's right. And I wonder if the same thing occurs in among people who work for the meat industry, whether their nutritionists are still eating meat.
Well, we've had some people on here that have been inspectors for the dairy industry, and I want to tell you some of the stories they tell are pretty scary, and I've no doubt about it, they don't consume milk or any of the dairy products. Again, this is Dr. John McDougall on KSRO Radio 1350, and my guest is actually Dr. Michael Jacobson. He's a PhD in microbiology, but most important, he is the director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. And the Center for Science and the Public Interest puts out a health letter. It's actually a magazine. It's called Nutrition Action. And I would encourage you to have this on your mailing list. It's an excellent publication. You can get a subscription for a year for $19.95 and for 2 years for $34.95. And you can call for credit card orders at 202-667-7483. That's 202-667-7483. And you can also write Nutrition Action Circulation, Suite 300, 1875 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. Also, there are many publications that Michael Jacobson has out, along with the Center for Science and the Public Interest. And the one you'll find in the bookstores now is The Fast Food Guide by Workman Publishing. And we're going to get into the issues of fast food after a break we take here. And Michael, you've got a book out now. In fact, I've seen you on talk shows trying to encourage people to eat healthier fast food. And the book, The Fast Food Guide, I guess, which is an update from the 1986 version, gives people an idea of what they're getting. How'd that come about?
Well, when we looked at fast foods about 8 years ago, we were just astonished at how awful these foods were. And the more closely we looked, the worse they got. So first we just saw foods with enormous amounts of fat, from the hamburgers, from the cheese, the bacon, the sour cream. And then when we looked a little closer, we saw that the fat was often saturated beef fat. You know, McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King were all frying foods in beef fat. They were frying potatoes in beef fat. So French fried potatoes would have more beef fat than a hamburger. They were frying chicken in it. They were frying even their apple pie in beef fat. So, and then we looked at, we turned on television, we saw McDonald's had an ad saying chicken McNuggets are made from nothing but chicken meat. So we looked at the chicken McNuggets more closely and discovered that they did have ground-up chicken meat, but they all also contained ground-up chicken skin as an additive, and then they were fried in beef fat.
Hmm.
Additives of all kinds were used. So we said, this is an area we got to work on, because tens of millions of people rely upon fast foods for their sustenance, especially low-income people, people without good refrigerators or supermarkets. And so back in 1986, I wrote a book called The Fast Food Guide about how awful the food was. And we also tried to get legislation requiring labeling. We kicked on certain companies for some of their terrible practices. And changes have been coming. And it's been very gratifying to see this huge industry learn what the word nutrition means. It had no meaning to the industry back before 1985 or 86. And now it seems that almost every chain is coming out with a few decent foods. Even places like Baskin-Robbins and Dairy Queen have non-fat frozen yogurt. McDonald's has carrot sticks and fat-free bran muffins. McDonald's, of course, has their lower-fat hamburgers, and they have very low-fat milkshakes. Burger King and Wendy's have grilled chicken sandwiches. A number of restaurants have salads or salad bars. So in the second edition of the Fast Food Guide, I found it easier to say something nice about some of these companies. And it seems now that if somebody wants to eat out or has to eat out because they're out on the road without any food, they can get a pretty decent meal at many fast food restaurants. That's quite a change from 5 years ago.
When you discover something, when you and your staff at the Center for Science and Public Interest, Michael Jacobson, discover something that concerns you, how do you go about bringing it to the public's attention? How do you go about making changes? Because I know, you know, these issues that you brought up have been at least the spark that started these changes.
Well, it usually starts with a lot of research. One of our goals in the mid-1980s was to get rid of all these tropical oils, coconut oil, palm kernel oil, from processed foods. So we started by doing this, and we were concerned about them because these oils promote heart disease even more effectively than beef fat promotes heart disease. So we wanted to do something about them and get the industry to change the way it prepares foods. So the first thing we did was a survey to identify hundreds of foods by brand name that have these saturated tropical oils. Then we published a report called The Saturated Fat Attack that generated a good deal of publicity. Then we got a large group of scientists to co-sign a letter to food manufacturers urging that they change the way they make their foods. Then we called on the Food and Drug Administration to label these fats more accurately. Most people think that vegetable oils are good, and in general, they're the best of the oils, but except for these tropical oils. So we asked the FDA to put in the words "a saturated fat" after the word "coconut oil" on the label. Each of these steps generated a good deal of publicity and caused many, many companies to change the way they made their foods. Now, we didn't get the FDA to make any institute a requirement for the words "a saturated fat," but we really raised this issue among the public and the food industry, and many companies went along with it because every heart doctor in the country knows that these are bad for the heart, and that there are substitutes. And for practically every company that used a tropical oil, we could find a competitor that didn't use it. So there have been some improvements. Not that the substitutes are always good. So there are some vegetable oils made with hydrogenated fats that have a strange kind of an oil, trans fatty acids, that may not be any better for us than saturated fats. But these tropical, there's nothing worse than these tropical oils.
Do they use them because they're cheap?
The tropical oils were the cheapest, yeah. And now that the demand has fallen, the price might be even cheaper.
Huh. So there's a great motivation to use the cheapest oil.
There's a motivation, but now there's so many people who are concerned about them that it's suicide for a company to come out with a significant product containing these tropical oils.
This is a rather broad question, but if you have some feelings on it or some expertise on it, I'd like to hear what you think about the new fat substitutes out on the market.
Well, they're different kinds of fat substitutes. There are fat-free salad dressings, ice cream, a number of other products that contain perfectly safe substitutes. These are generally carbohydrates. They're thickening agents that industry has learned how to use in such a way that they simulate the what is called in the industry the mouthfeel, the texture of a food with it normally contains fat. And Simplex is one of those. Simplex is actually made from protein that's been treated in such a way that it feels more like a fat when we chew it. And I'm not at all concerned about those fat substitutes.
How about the issue we just talked about a few minutes ago, and that is the excess animal protein, which Simplex is, causing calcium imbalances leading to kidney stones and osteoporosis?
I guess that generally when something like Simplex is used, it doesn't add much protein to the food. And, you know, the major change really is cutting down on fat. Now, you could still argue that it's bad because it will make these foods high in protein more acceptable nutritionally, and people might eat more of them. And that's possible. And in fact, somebody might eat a piece of fat-free coffee cake at breakfast rather than a piece of fruit, or fat-free ice cream instead of a piece of fruit. And I think we do need to monitor the impact of these foods. But I'd certainly prefer a fat-free sour cream to a regular fat sour cream. There are some fat substitutes that may turn out to be problems. One of them is olestra. It's a substance made by Procter & Gamble that FDA has not yet approved. It's been poorly tested, but the tests that have been done indicate it increases the risks of cancer and liver damage in rats, and there's a good chance that it's a problem for people. We'll have to see how FDA rules in the next, it'll probably be 2 or 3 years before FDA has to make a decision, but I'm hoping that olestra never sees the light of day.
Well, some of the fat-free products, particularly the coffee cakes and the cookies and so on, they take the fat out, but they replace it with something else that I believe concerns you, and that is a lot of simple sugar.
Well, actually, I'm not sure if they have much more simple sugar, but cookies, even without a fat substitute, have plenty of sugar, and that's something else that people ought to cut down on. The average person probably consumes about 90 pounds of simple sugars, refined carbohydrates, each year. That's an awful lot. That's, a quarter of a pound a day. And some people, probably most of your listeners, don't consume anywhere near that much, but they are averaged in with some of your non-listeners who are eating much more. And there's some obvious problems with sugar, like tooth decay. It probably promotes obesity. And it replaces better foods from the diet. So somebody who has 20% of their calories from soda pop has to get 100% of their nutrients from just 80% of their food. And for somebody who drinks a few bottles of soda pop a day, it's very unlikely to happen.
The trend in America today is to switch to vegetable oils like olive oil, safflower oil, and I think you've alluded to the fact that there are some benefits there, but are there also some drawbacks?
Well, the biggest question, of course, is that they're high in calories. All fats and oils, whether it's beef fat or olive oil or soybean oil, contain the same number of calories. So people concerned about their waistlines should cut down on all kinds of fat. There's some evidence that diets high in fat promote cancer, and it may be more animal fats than vegetable fats to do, but I think that the message from all the scientific research that has been done is that we ought to cut down on all kinds of fat. And it doesn't mean we can't have any fat. We certainly are going to get some fat from our food, and a teaspoon of olive oil in a salad is not going to hurt anybody. But a major objective for the American public is to cut down on fats, and fats of all kinds.
And they seem to be doing it, don't they, as they get the message out. Isn't that encouraging to you, Michael Jacobson, that as you take the effort to put the message out to the American public, that you see them responding in a positive way?
Certainly millions and millions of people are moving in a healthy direction. Not everybody. And I think there'll be some people who go to the grave with a pork chop in their mouths. But the kids are learning more about nutrition. The food industry is improving their products. Look, you know, when the fast food industry allows vegetables onto their premises, you know something is happening. And I think we're going to continue moving in this direction, propelled by more and more medical research and more public education.
The lunch hour is coming up here pretty soon, and a lot of people are going to eat in fast food restaurants. If you were going to recommend the best that they could order, what would you suggest for a fast food meal for lunch today?
I'd suggest a salad and a baked potato.
Sounds like a vegetarian, Michael Jacobson.
No problem with that. And if you want to put a little margarine on the baked potato, go ahead. And put some low-calorie salad dressing on the salad, and don't add too much cheese.
Well, there you go. For all the way from Washington, D.C. with Michael Jacobson, you got a recommendation to have a potato and a salad for lunch. This is Dr. John McDougall on KSR Radio 1350. My guest is Michael Jacobson. What do you think of FDA Commissioner David Kessler?
He's a breath of fresh air, believe me.
I bet.
After 10 years of nitwits and dingbats and do-nothings, this is a guy who actually wants to improve our food supply. It's really quite amazing. And I think he's really motivated the FDA bureaucracy, has led Congress and the public to have some faith that the agency really cares about the public's health. And I hope he sticks around for a while.
Yeah, well, you know how that goes. I hope he does, too. And when I first heard him interviewed, I thought about you, Michael. I thought that, you know, here's a man that sees things the way you do, and I bet you have a good relationship with him.
We do, yeah. And it's nice to have a commissioner who we can talk to and who does something. You know, on the simplest level, he goes shopping. He tries to read food labels. He deals with these problems. I never had the feeling that any previous commissioner actually went into a grocery store, actually read the label on a box. There have been scientists, physicians, and they were maybe interested in the science of some issue, but never wanted to really help consumers. And I think Kessler wants to have a safer food supply, better labeled foods, and also deal with drugs as well. Now, there's a lot of resistance. He's not getting everything he wants. He'd like to have more power for his agency, but the Bush administration won't let him. They told him to shut up on that point. And we'll see what happens in the next year or so with the election, and I think some people in the food industry would certainly like to get rid of Kessler. But he's certainly built up a faith in the Food and Drug Administration leadership in Congress, and if the industry tries to do away with Kessler, the Congress can hopefully try to prevent that.
Well, they have other problems these days that seem to be more important. So hopefully they will get around to that. Food labeling is a very important issue for you, Michael Jacobson, and you are involved in the politics of food labeling, but it just makes so much sense from a consumer's point of view that foods ought to be properly labeled. Why the resistance?
Well, the industry is moving along in the right direction, but it's kicking and screaming. Just today, the Department of Agriculture is announcing that they're going to postpone implementation of better food labeling for a year beyond the May 1993 deadline that was originally set. And it's not clear yet if they have the legal authority to do it. They probably do have the authority to delay the implementation.
Is this kind of like...
The meat industry doesn't want to have nutrition information on the labels because so much meat, especially processed meats, are so loaded with fat and salt. They're embarrassed. And so every year that they can postpone labeling, the greater their sales will be. But there will be better labeling. It may take... originally, it's going to be about a year from now. Maybe in some cases, it'll be a little longer. But I think sooner or later, people will have much better labeling than they have now.
Well, this sounds to me similar to the Clean Air Act being postponed so that automakers can make a little bit more money.
That's right. And this is, President Bush wants to delay all regulations, maybe between now and the election, to show industry what a great friend he is of theirs. But he's certainly no friend to the public when he delays such important regulations as food labeling.
Let's take a call here. We have Michael on the line with Michael Jacobson. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Good. You have a question for Michael Jacobson?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a question for both of you. I don't know if either of you are informed about this, but I was listening to a radio show the other day. It wasn't yours. It was on American Public Radio. They were talking about how the FDA wants to start regulating the vitamin industry. I'm wondering if either of you have heard about that.
Probably Michael Jacobson has.
I'm not sure exactly what the caller is referring to, but there's legislation in Congress that would give the FDA more authority to inspect manufacturing facilities, and that would cover the vitamin industry as well as Betty Crocker's plants. And I don't know if the legislation is going anywhere this year or not, but I don't think that the vitamin industry is going to be subjected to any greater regulation than it is now.
You know what? Actually, it wasn't that. It wasn't inspecting plants. It had something to do with where they were going to have more control over the sale of vitamins, where they were going to try to make it where you can only buy vitamins through doctors and give the power, to the medical industry, basically.
I haven't heard of that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anybody propose something like that seriously.
Well, thank you for calling, Michael.
Okay.
I got a question for you along those lines. There is legislation in many states that would prevent anybody but a registered dietitian from giving out nutritional advice. What do you think about that legislation, Michael Jacobson?
I'm very nervous about that kind of legislation, creating a monopoly for dietitians. They certainly don't have a monopoly on nutrition information. And I think that states need to be very careful when they move ahead like that and not create a monopoly that will be a disservice to the public. Now, a number of states have that legislation. I haven't followed the issue closely, so I don't know if there are very well qualified people who have been prevented from providing advice. It's something I'm not an expert on, so I can't say too much.
Well, if they do pass that legislation, then I think they ought to put a clause in there that all dietitians must be at trim body weight, have a cholesterol below 150, and off all blood pressure medications before they're being there.
That's a good idea.
I know so many fat dietitians, is the reason I say that.
Yeah.
Experts on
it. I've dumped on a dietitian or two in my time, but it's interesting that I think that the world of dietetics is moving with the times also, along with the fast food industry and processed food industry. There's a vegetarian section of the American Dietetic Association that's growing by leaps and bounds. And it's not as quite as monolithic as it used to be, although there certainly is... It's really a staunchly establishment group that has some pretty close ties to the meat and dairy industries.
But you would clearly say that you're encouraged by what's happening and you're excited about it, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. When you think of where things were 20 years ago, nobody cared about nutrition. you're labeled a nut if you so much as suggested that foods were related to diseases that we were suffering from. And now you can't get away from that information.
Well, part of the reason, Michael Jacobson, is because you and your group have made a tremendous difference. And I want to thank you very much for being with me this hour.
So, thank you very much, guys.
And
I enjoyed it.
And I look forward to our next encounter. It's really exciting to know you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.